Lierre is on the line, and are you there, Lierre?
I am here.
Super duper duper. Me very happy. How you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for calling, and thanks for wanting to interview me.
Well, I wouldn't hardly know where to begin to tell you the effect that your book has had on me and that I suspect is going to have on many, many, many people. I actually wrote a lovely introduction for you, and I'm not even going to dig it out and fumble around with it because here you are, and we can just dive right in. I'll give a cursory introduction. Lierre Keith was unknown to me just a few short weeks ago, and someone told me that there was this book out called The Vegetarian Myth by Lierre Keith, and that I might want to take a look at it. So I did. I bought the book when it was still available. The first printing evidently sold out pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And if you'll allow me, Lierre, I'd like to just take a minute or two and introduce you from my heart, as best I can right now, because I think it's worthwhile to set the table a little bit. This show is called What Now? Oh, I didn't get your permission yet. Is that all right?
Oh, it's totally fine. You're very sweet. Thank you.
Okay. This show is called What Now? And it's only about 9-10 weeks old. And it's kind of an amateur operation. We're at a very tiny little station in Occidental, California. And from the very first show, I've been telling listeners about an institution called the Weston A. Price Foundation, which is something that I and other people discovered in the last year or two or three or four. And it's a very, very important institution in our country right now, and in our collective conversation and consideration of diet, health, the welfare of the earth, nutrition, all these things, which is a very hot topic these days. So I've been telling people about the Weston A. Price Foundation to Google WAPF, because that's a simple Google that could mean a lot to a lot of people. And so I read this book, and I'm a reader. I read books, and I can count on the fingers of maybe one and a half hands the books in my lifetime. And I'm in my 60s now. I've read quite a number of books compared to the average bear. And there are very few books that have had the kind of effect on me or impact on me that this book has had. So let me just stop there. I would love to read all these wonderful words I wrote, but it would be too clumsy right now. Thanks for coming on, Lierre.
Well, thank you for your wonderful introduction.
I understand the second printing is now available?
It's here, indeed, and yours have been mailed.
Excellent. And I hope the bookstores have them, and I hope the libraries are ordering many copies, because I think the book is a phenomenon, and I think it's an incalculably valuable education for all of us, and a very forceful and clear perspective on the most fundamental and crucial issues in our lives.
Well, thank you for saying all that. I'm very touched.
Well, it's true. So, if you'd like to make any opening comments or anything like that, what I'd like to do is to begin to talk about the book.
Great.
Is there anything you'd like to say before we begin?
You know, the only thing I'd like to preface with is saying that, you know, this is a topic that gets people very emotional. And, I mean, I was a vegan for 20 years, and I know how intense it is when you are a vegan and how central it becomes to your whole worldview. And it's not even what you eat. It really becomes who you are. You know, it's an issue of identity in the end. And so that makes it really hard to hear information that may be counter to your worldview, because you feel like you are being threatened. you know, it's not just the information. It's that you feel like your sense of self is under attack. And it makes it really hard for people to stay open. And so I guess my plea to people who are listening, if you are a vegetarian or a vegan, I know what it's going to cost you to sit through this. And I would really urge you to do it because the basic values that underlie the vegetarian ethic of justice and sustainability and compassion, those are the only values that are going to get us to the world that we need. And those values are not at issue. This really is just a question of information. And I know that you all think you are doing the right thing by being vegans or vegetarians, but the hard truth is that you're not. And that's where the lack of information comes in. And this is a broad cultural ignorance. It's not just vegetarians, vegans, clearly, who don't understand this. But it really is about the nature of agriculture. And since this has been, you know, a project of 10,000 years now for the human race, it's not even something that people question. And we need to be questioning in that way. Level because of what's at stake. So I hope that, you know, with all the passion that vegetarians and vegans have for a better world, that, you know, you will apply that passion to this conversation and try to actually hear what I'm saying rather than feeling threatened or getting too reactive that you shut down. And I just want to, you know, acknowledge that is a really hard thing to do, that I had been there. And so I really appreciate those of you who stick it out.
Hear, hear. I know that you must have gone through this process yourself.
Yeah.
And you write about it quite eloquently that it's not a simple thing to receive knowledge into the heart of your identity that calls into question some of the pillars of that identity.
Right.
Very threatening. You wrote in the book a quote: "You're never the same after some knowledge gets through with you."
Right.
And that's what I think we're going to see happening with many people when they get their teeth into this book.
Right.
If you don't mind, I'd like to consider this book going backwards. There's an introductory chapter, and then there's a chapter on morality, politics, nutrition, and then the final chapter is called Saving the World. And I'd like to run through these chapters backwards.
Okay.
So let's start with saving the world. I had a wonderful talk, at least in my opinion. I had a good talk with Stephanie McMillan earlier in the show, and we kind of agreed that really the only good reason to be alive these days is to be committed, to be engaged, fully engaged in the challenge of saving the world. So. Let's talk about saving the world. Is it savable? Are we savable? Are we too far gone? Can we pull our behinds out of the fire?
Theoretically, anything's possible. And, you know, the statistic that I like to tell people, the fact that I like to give out at this point, is that if we took all the agricultural land, essentially east of the Mississippi, and put it back into prairie and forest, so put it back into grassland where it wants to be, we, the United States, would immediately become a net carbon sink. And that is with everybody still driving SUVs from here to hell, okay? That's without any other changes that need to happen. If the entire planet did this, took all the land that's been destroyed by agriculture and put it back into what I call perennial polycultures, so either grasslands or forests, essentially, if we let those ecosystems come back, those living communities that build and protect topsoil, if we would just help that, repair the planet, let that come back, within 9 to 10 years, we could sequester all of the carbon that has been released since the beginning of the industrial age. Now, that is an incredible fact. It is not too late for this planet. The point is, though, that we need to understand where the damage lies so that we can repair it. And I feel like the environmental movement is, A, not telling the truth, and, B, a lot of them don't even understand the problem. And that's where I end up being in a lot of despair, is because the people who should care the most don't even understand what's wrong. So they keep, you know, telling us to eat this plant-based diet, and they're just wrong, because that is the origin of the harm. That is where industrialization began, was with agriculture. That's the beginning of civilization. So in order to repair this planet, we've got to restore those forests and grasslands that agriculture devours. At that point, we've got hope for the planet. We can sequester that carbon and keep this planet from becoming too hot to support life. But I fear that people don't want to hear that message. And I don't think that this is some kind of terrible conspiracy, but, you know, the environmental movement has really been led astray. We've been given completely the wrong strategy, and that is a frustration, because we're starting at a negative, when we're not even just at neutral. Everybody's been told that this plant-based diet is the way to go, and so we have to sort of overcome that first and then move on to talk about what would really save the planet. So that's, you know, I would say the main reason why I wrote the book is because, you know, my planet is under assault and we are out of time. So I agree that this, you know, this is the moment, and that really the only reason to be alive right now is to take up your warrior spirit and, you know, get out there and, you know, whatever it takes and whatever you're good for, we have to do it.
Okay, so let's talk about polycultures and monocultures, monocrops, annuals against perennials.
That's right.
Why don't you run that down?
Okay. So you have to understand the nature of agriculture, which is that you take a piece of land and you clear every living thing off it, and then you plant it to human use. And what you're planting are called annual monocrops. So that would be corn or wheat or soy or rice or whatever. And they're annuals because they only live for a short season or two. Now, annuals have a place in nature, and it's a very important place, and that is when there's a disaster, and the soil is cleared for some terrible reason, like a flood or a fire. Bare soil is a biological disaster for the planet, and the planet responds as it is, you know, to an emergency. So the first responders to this emergency are the annual crops. Annuals reproduce by producing large seed heads. They don't reproduce by roots or by runners or by, the way that grass, for instance. I mean, if you think of grass, when you try to pull up grass, you know, there's this endless, endless long runner under the ground, or, any kind of, or like a tree that falls in the forest. I mean, most trees will actually, those stump sprouts will spring up from the roots, or redwoods when they fall. All along the length of that fallen trunk, you will find saplings springing up. So perennials can reproduce in all these different ways because they have a long time to live. Annuals are only going to live for a year or two. They have to put everything into that giant seed. So, you know, they produce and then reproduce, and then the seeds fall to the ground, and then there's usually a long, long period of time where nothing happens because they cannot compete against the dense root mat that the perennials create. Now, the perennials do that in order to build and protect topsoil. That's literally the scaffolding on which topsoil is built, is those roots from perennial polycultures. So, you know, the annual seeds fall and they wait for their time. And the time comes when there's another disaster and the soil is cleared. That's when they have their moment, because now they don't have to outcompete the roots. So the annuals come to the fore and they're the first responders. They're like the Band-Aid that is, you know, held over the wound. And then your skin knitting back together, you know, the actual repair, that's the perennials coming back in. And so they will take over that spot again, and they will once again knit together those dense root systems that will protect the topsoil. And that's how nature works. So, you know, annuals have a really, really important role to play as those first responders. So now you get to agriculture. Well, the problem is that, you know, humans, for whatever reason, have gotten addicted to agricultural foods, corn and wheat and soy and these kinds of annual seeds, they contain opioids. So, in fact, a lot of people think that this is the reason people started doing agriculture, was it's simply addictive. The foods are addictive. There's not really any other explanation that makes sense, because it's piss poor nutrition for backbreaking labor. Hunter-gatherers live a life of relative ease and very good nutrition, and agriculture enters the picture, and immediately human skeletons shrink 6 inches and they lose their teeth. So, you know, this has really been a disaster.
That's a tip-off right there.
It's been a disaster for human health and for human society as well as the planet. So in order to grow those seeds, because we're talking about annuals, it means that the earth has to be cleared. So over and over and over, this has been the pattern. Agriculture started in 6 different spots around the world. The thing to know about it is that it did start only in river valleys. So these are places that were regularly flooded. There were a lot of annuals to choose from because the ground was disturbed a lot. And I think that that's really the only reason why. So given, you know, this palette of more annuals than anywhere else, a few of them hooked into the pleasure centers in the human brain. So what happens next is agriculture spreads because it's an inherently destructive process. You clear the ground, you plant your annuals, the ground is no longer protected. It doesn't have that dense root mat that's protecting it, and it doesn't have the cellulose from above, so the leaves or the grass stems, protecting it from wind and rain and sun. So the moment that it's cleared, you're going to have destruction of the soil. So eventually, of course, you're going to use up that soil. You need to move on. And this is the beginning of imperialism. So you use up your resources. Well, you've got to take somebody else's. The other thing that it adds is a class of people whose job is essentially to be soldiers. Agriculture produces a surplus, and that means that some people, full-time, can do nothing but be military. So it also requires the military, because you're going to have to continuously go out, get more resources, more soil, more trees, more slaves, because this is backbreaking labor, bring it back to this bloated power center in the middle of it all. And that is the pattern that's been going on for 10,000 years. Originally, this pattern of the bloated power center was limited by supply lines. When you didn't have fossil fuel and, you know, before the internet and telephones, you know, you could only get supplies so far using just human feet and horses. And certainly CENTCOM couldn't get orders out. So, you know, imperialism was a tricky business past a certain amount of just distance. So it was limited by that distance. Eventually all the resources would be used up and it collapsed, and then it would rise up somewhere else. So that's what's been going on, I mean, for 10,000 years, and it's been a very, very destructive, you know, set of activities for both human culture, because you've got imperialism, slavery, patriarchy, you know, all kinds of hierarchy involved, racism, and then for the planet, it's been an absolute disaster. We are now out of topsoil. There is none left. Agriculture has blown through every continent, and by 1950, there should have been this collapse in population because we completely overshot, but what happened instead was the Green Revolution. So eventually that population correction is still facing us. But for now, what we're eating is fossil fuel. So having drawn down all the resources of the topsoil, scientists figured out that they could make nitrogen fertilizer out of fossil fuel. And so that's what we've been eating as a species since 1950. Clearly, that is not a plan with the future. So now our population is well beyond not just what our planet could support, but what fossil fuel can support. As the oil and the gas get harder and harder to come by, it's not going to be pretty out there. And I think that this is one of the things that we need to face if we are people who care about justice and sustainability, is we've really backed ourselves into a corner as a species, and we need to take that seriously and, you know, face what our options are. I mean, we've got to repair those perennial polycultures to sequester the carbon, and also for species extinction. I mean, it's 120 species a day going extinct. That's because of agriculture. And we need to stop taking over this planet and live again as members of a community, of a living biotic community, where we play a role like everybody else. But so that needs to happen. How to do that with 6 billion people? Well, it's not possible. So, you know, we need to really understand that we've overshot. Hunter-gatherers are very good at keeping their populations at sustainable levels, because it's a very tight correspondence between, you know, if you have too many people, you are hungry pretty much right away. You get that you overshot. With agriculture, you know, it's gone on for 10,000 years, and we are yet to realize that we've overshot. I mean, and it's going to be really ugly if we don't face facts now. So, does that answer your question? That was a lot in one answer.
Well, good. I'm quoting from the book now. You say, farming, the growing of annual monocrops, will never be sustainable. Our only chance is a judicious and humble human participation in perennial polycultures.
That's right.
And you also wrote, whatever we're eating has to build soil, and mm-hmm. if it doesn't, it has to be struck forever from the human menu.
Yeah, I stand by both of those statements.
You agree with that?
I do.
Well, I find it all quite thrilling. Because you're putting before us a lot of crucial truth.
Right.
And I have no doubt that what you're putting before us is correct, and it's new to us. It's a shock. It's a shock to confront this.
Yeah, we have not been given this information anywhere. And you know, it took me a long time to put it all together. I mean, when I was 19, I'd been a vegan for 3 years at that point, and I actually had a biology professor in college who said to me point blank, he said, the moment you put a plow to soil, you destroy that soil. I mean, he got it, you know, and I've had a lot of email from people like that who are biologists of, you know, one color or another, and they're the people who are like, you know, you're absolutely telling the truth, and it's got to be sad. But getting that out to a popular audience and getting those ideas out to the people who claim to care, who, you know, make that claim to justice,
right.
That's hard. because, you know, they've been given a completely different set of facts. And no,
nobody said it would be easy. You no. quote Stephen Stahl in the book, a writer who wrote about soil, who you quote him saying, "The plow is the world's most feared wrecking ball."
Yeah. Because it means taking over entire ecosystems. I mean, right. I write in the book that agriculture is carnivorous and what it eats entire continents. And that's what it means. You pull down the forest and you plow up the prairie and you drain the wetland and you just turn it over to human use for as long as the soil lasts. And then you move on. And it means that all the animals and all the other creatures that should be sharing this planet with us have been pushed off into extinction. Right. And ultimately it's agriculture that's the cause of that.
Right. Let's move into nutrition. Let's consider this from the viewpoint of nutrition.
Well, you already mentioned Weston Price, and, you know, it doesn't get any better than that. I personally feel like the Weston Price Foundation, Sally Fallon and everybody there, they really saved my life because my health had just completely collapsed after 20 years of being a vegan, and I didn't understand why. I just knew that I had to do something different. And finding the Weston Price information was really, I wouldn't say eye-opening, but it was way more profound than that. I mean, it was just huge.
Right.
So you're probably, many of your listeners already know, but Weston Price was a dentist who lived in Cleveland, Ohio, and in the 1930s he had been watching as his patients, their dentition had deteriorated over the previous decade, and he was trying to figure out why. But suddenly he was seeing terrible dental problems in young children especially that he had never seen before. Their teeth didn't fit in their mouths, their teeth were coming in backwards, you know, tremendous decay even at, you know, 2 and 3 years old. What was this about? And he had a feeling it had something to do with nutrition because at that point the American diet was already shifting toward not just agricultural foods but really industrialized, you know, the worst version of this. And he had a feeling that had something to do with it, but he wanted to prove it. So it was a great moment in history. It was the perfect moment for somebody like Dr. Price because there were still people all over the planet who were remote enough from industrial culture that they were still living a fairly traditional lifestyle, which meant you could find out what they ate and what effect did it have on their health. The other thing that happened was that the camera was actually portable right about then. So it meant that he could take photographs. And this was the thing that really affected me. You know, they say picture's worth 1,000 words. Well, it was the photographs in that book that completely stopped me cold because he documented, well, here's the parents and the grandparents, and you see these absolutely gorgeous teeth and these perfect faces, and they have no degenerative diseases, no chronic illnesses. They don't even have any mental illnesses, and they're eating these nutrient-dense animal foods. And then you get to the first generation born to parents who have started to eat, you know, white flour, white sugar, vegetable oil, whatever it is that, you know, has destroyed their cultures, and they start eating the white man's food, essentially, and it all goes to hell. And so you see pictures of the first generation. They've got these terrible teeth, and you can see their faces are way too narrow, and, you know, the bridges of their noses, they're not going to be able to breathe right, and some of them have club feet, and they've got arthritis and all kinds of, you know, bone problems. And I have a degenerative disease of the spine. And what looking at these pictures was like, I did this to myself, you know? Because
right.
here's all these cultures where this didn't exist. And from, you know, taking out the nutrient-dense foods, what I ended up with was a skeleton that couldn't hold me up. So it was really an eye-opener, and it was profoundly shocking to sort of absorb into my heart that I had really been led astray by, you know, the vegan worldview and had really believed in it and had done my best with it, and I was really fanatical about it. I mean, I was very pure. I was not a vegan junk food addict. I mean, I know lots of vegans who eat brownies and Duncan Hines, whatever. That was not me. I mean, I didn't touch white sugar, and this is what happens when you do not give the human template the food that it requires. So Weston Price, you cannot be moved, you know, if you look at these photographs. It's just phenomenal, and it's on every single continent. It's in Europe. It's in Asia. Everywhere that he went, he found the same experience. So that really made me reevaluate everything that I was doing. And I think that the Weston Price Foundation is doing a phenomenal job getting this information out to the public.
Go ahead.
Say what you're going to say.
Just Google WAPF.
Yeah. It's WestonAPrice.org. And it's a wealth of information. But, you know, one of their main things is that we need the nutrient-dense animal foods.
Define nutrient-dense food, please.
Well, it would be food that basically contains a lot of nutrients, and it's the nutrients that human beings need. So it would be the fat-soluble vitamins, especially vitamin A and vitamin D. It would also include vitamin K, though there are some plant sources of that. And then the fats themselves are absolutely crucial to every function in your body. We need cholesterol. Cholesterol has been utterly demonized over the last 30 years. And I sort of look at that philosophically, and I think here's this incredibly life-promoting substance, and we've been told over and over that it will kill us. And I have to think that this is just the ultimate death urge of this culture, to take the food that has been valued and even considered sacred, you know, for as long as we've been human. You go back to the very beginning of art and religion in the human psyche, and what did we draw? We drew fat women, and we drew beautiful ruminant animals that we were eating, and that's what gave us life. You know, it was our mothers and these animals, and that was what we worshipped. That was the impulse that, you know, drew us to begin to have religious consciousness, and that's why it's on the cover of my book. You know, like this is what it meant to be human, was to participate in that and to celebrate it and to learn to worship that. But, you know, we've gone completely in the wrong direction now. And here you, at the end of this culture that has done nothing but destroy, we've got anorexic beauty standards, and we've got, you know, these health-giving foods being absolutely demonized so that we're all sick all the time. So we need animal fats, and we need cholesterol in our diets. Every single cell in your body is built from cholesterol. You would be a puddle on the floor without cholesterol. Your brain is almost 70% fat. And without adequate saturated fat in your diet, your brain cannot function. You will have depression. You will be suicidal. You will be violent. The terrible anxiety. All of this is what happens when you do not have enough saturated fat in your diet. And I lived that way for 20 years. I can tell you it's true. All it took was a little bit of animal fat, and I was a completely new person. And I would say that the majority of people who write to me over email and send me thank you letters, that's the number one reason. It's because they had just this tremendous anxiety and depression, could not feel any joy or any happiness, and decided to try what's in the book. They introduced some animal foods into their diet, and in 2 weeks, it's all gone. And they are profoundly thankful that, you know, their lives have been restored to them because their brains can function finally. We need animal fat. So, you know, that's a really big thing that, you know, and the pharmaceuticals are making a lot of money off of this. There are vested interests against us. Lipitor is the number one selling drug in the world. That's a statin drug that's supposed to lower your cholesterol. So all of this is stuff that you're going to have to investigate, whoever you are out there in listener land. It's hard because we've been told so much. All of our public health organizations are against us at this point. You've got to do some more digging around to find the real truth about cholesterol and saturated fat, but it's there.
Right. It's a business model behind all of this. The soy industry and the corn industry, et cetera, et cetera. Can you talk a little about carnivores and ruminants and cellulose?
Sure. So this all makes a biotic community, a living community, and we all participate. So what that means is, well, the basic source of energy on the planet is the sun, okay? The sun shines every day, and it provides heat and warmth and light and things that we need. And the people on the planet who can actually turn that energy into matter are plants, and they do that by photosynthesis. And this is a really awe-inspiring, amazing thing that, you know, somebody figured out how to do that. So plants do that. So they've got green leaves, and they absorb sunshine, and they grow. So, all right, that's one form of life on the planet, and everybody's trying to figure out what to eat. So if there's a niche, somebody will fill it. Along comes other kinds of creatures, animals, for instance, and they figured out how to eat plants. So they themselves do not absorb energy directly from the sun, but they figured out how to eat the people who do that. So now you've got creatures like ruminants. What's happening inside a cow is actually really fascinating. She's got this vast fermentative vat in which she keeps bacteria. So the bacteria live in there, and she feeds the grass to the bacteria by eating. That's what she's doing, is she's providing food for those bacteria. The bacteria actually break down the cellulose, and then she eats the bacteria. So she feeds the bacteria, and then she eats the bacteria. And you could look at it the other way and say, hey, the bacteria were really smart, and they figured out a way to get fed and to get carried around in a protected environment. You know, I don't particularly look at this as, you know, one creature dominating another. I think that we are all in this together, and these are symbiotic relationships. We are all interrelated. So on the small scale, you've got the, you know, the cellulose, the plants, you've got the cows, you've got the bacteria. All together, they make a functioning community. In the end, they're all producing more topsoil. The cow is adding, you know, nutrients through her manure, through urine especially is very nutrient rich, and the grass really needs that. In very dry places, the biological activity in the soil actually can come to a halt because there's not enough moisture. And at that point, it's incredibly crucial to have the right browsers and ruminants on that grass, because they're the ones who then take up the functions of degrading, because the bacteria can't do the job. So the bacteria inside the cow then are the ones who are really breaking down the nutrients for further life, for more plants and more soil. But that's true everywhere. You always are going to need animals to do that job. So then you've got the next layer, which is people like us. We're simply just, I mean, we're consumers. We're not really adding much to this process. But, you know, the cows can eat the grass. Humans can't eat grass. We don't have a mechanism to digest cellulose. But what we can eat is fat and protein. So we eat the cows. And then we die as well, and the grass eats us. And what I like to say is that in the end, the topsoil eats us all. So you've got this, you know, very, this resilient, community of living creatures, and it's resilient because there's so many of them doing it. And you need lots and lots of diversity in an ecosystem to give it that resilience. So, I mean, the other thing, of course, is that, you know, without predators, without the carnivores, the ruminants have developed along with us, and they have no way to keep their populations in check. It's not like, you know, they know to go to the family planning clinic because there's too many. What keeps ruminants in check, what keeps animals in check, is other animals that eat them. So eventually there's a balance that's struck between the consumers, the degraders, the plants, the animals, the carnivores, and we all have a role to play. If there's no animals grazing or browsing in a forest or a grassland, it will eventually turn to desert. The grass needs to be eaten. And the same could be true of, the same could be said of the cows, that without somebody to eat the cows or the zebras or the horses or whoever your browser or grazer is, without somebody to keep those numbers in check, the same thing will happen. They will, you know, they'll overpopulate, and they will overgraze and eventually destroy the ecosystem as well and turn everything to desert. So all of us play a role in this cycle. And I like to think of it as, you know, we're all members of the tribe called carbon. And we're just taking turns around the circle of life. And that was very hard for me as a vegetarian to accept that. I wanted my life to be possible without death, and it's not. I mean, at every point, you know, for one creature to live, another one had to die. But altogether, we make more life, and that's the point. That as species, we work together in this cooperative process, which is about making life happen.
Right. And this needs to happen as a totality, because not only do we want to be well and need to be well for our own well-being, but we need everyone else to be well also.
Right.
We need everyone to be well,
right,
if we're going to go forward.
Right.
So this is a this needs to be a total. Basically, I think one of the things you're doing is that you're modeling. You're modeling reality for us. You're modeling earthly reality, and it creates, just like Joel Salatin has modeled,
right,
intelligent farming.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You're modeling this on a macro level. You're modeling the naked intelligence of the earth,
right,
and our obligation to adapt ourselves to that intelligence.
Right. Because agriculture is a process of trying to adapt the earth to us, and it's never going to work. So we need to go in the other direction and instead just be participants in functioning biotic communities.
We can develop topsoil.
Right. We need to be members of soil-building communities rather than being parasites on the soil.
Right. And you see, this is I'm still in shock from the book, because I for many years I was involved in something called natural hygiene, which was essentially a vegan protocol. I did quite a few lengthy water only fasts and on like that, and we've been so brainwashed about the lipid hypothesis and cholesterol and the evil of animal fat, and saturated fat is the devil, and we bit. I mean, we really took that in very deeply.
Yeah.
And I'm sure if you stopped 100 people on the street, 99 would say that saturated fat is to be avoided at all costs.
Oh yeah.
And it's so. It's just extraordinary what the business model can do, what our you know, our being enthralled with the very concept of money, what the whole money economy has just ruined us, has ruined and ruined the planet.
Right.
And as you say, there's no time left. So this is, this book, of course, it's not an accident that it's appearing right now. You know, it's too bad it didn't appear a year ago. But I'm sure you've done the best. It's a thrill to have this book appear in the human, in the midst of the human crisis at this time. And I think it has great potential to turn us on a dime, because the evidence, the articulation, the delineation of all the knowledge and, that you present to us, I think it would be very, very hard for anybody to argue against it at this stage of the game. I don't think there's much, whatever opposition there would be to this might be psychological and emotional and spiritual, but it certainly is never going to be scientific or like that. So this is a great boon to us. Let's move into, is there anything else we want to talk about in terms of nutrition? What you're saying is that good quality animal fat and protein, is essential to our good health. And what else do you want to say? Because I want to move into the political sphere.
Right. I guess the only other aside I would make is that, please stop eating soy if you are eating it. And please do some more research before you put another drop of soy milk into your body, because soy has been so destructive to me and to other people in my life. And there's a lot of really good information out there that will walk you through step by step exactly why soy is not an appropriate food for human as, you know, a protein source. It's okay as a highly fermented condiment once in a while, not a big deal, but not as a protein source, and certainly not as, you know, these highly industrial waste products that have been, you know, turned into, you know, some kind of greenwashing, and sold to us, as yuppie food. And they're really not, I mean, I just shudder every time I see somebody putting soy milk in their cart with their small children. It's really hard not to just interrupt the process and beg them not to, but we've got to confront the soy industry. It's just destroying people right and left. And
evidently,
I've gotten a lot of email from people saying, oh my God, it was the soy. Thank you so much. And, you know, on with the health problems that they now have from the soy.
Right. It's actually dangerous.
Yeah, it is very dangerous. It'll destroy your thyroid. The hormones will, you know, mess you up pretty permanently. It blocks the absorption of minerals in your body, so that, you know, you're going to end up with osteoporosis or arthritis from that. Certainly depression, you know, from the zinc. Lots and lots of problems with soy. There's also trypsin inhibitors in the soy, which can give you tremendous stomach aches and diarrhea and all kinds of digestive upset. And you might not know that's what's causing it. So you take the soy out of your diet, and what do you know? It all goes away. So.
You want to tell people about Julia Ross or the gut and psychology syndrome?
Yeah.
That stuff?
Absolutely.
Gary Taubes. You want to talk about Gary Taubes?
Yeah, any of them are great. Julia Ross wrote wonderful, wonderful books. She also runs a clinic. Her book is called The Mood Cure. And she also recommends an appropriate human diet that's got based on animal fat and animal protein. But her main idea is how she came to this was she was an addictions counselor, so trying to help people get sober. And none of the models really work. I mean, they don't have a long-term success rate of more than 3 or 4%. So she started to wonder, maybe our model is wrong. Maybe we don't understand what's wrong. Why are people addicted? Maybe it's not psychological. And through her research, she discovered that, in fact, there are other models, and that some of them say that actually the problem is brain chemistry, that people drink or they do drugs because they're missing, they don't have enough neurotransmitters.
Mm-hmm.
So the only time their brains feel okay is when they're drinking or drugging. And if you're fighting your brain chemistry, you're not going to win. So at her clinic and in her books, she describes a nutrition plan where you're eating, you know, enough animal fat and protein that, you know, it actually can support brain function. But she also supplements with different amino acids, which, of course, are just kinds of protein. So depending on what, you know, your profile is and what your drug cravings are, she can give you a program, you know, set you up with a specific kind of protocol to match the amino acids that you're probably missing with what your craving is. So at her clinic, they have an 80% success rate. And if you know anything about addiction counseling, that's phenomenal. I mean, it's just miraculous. So I highly, highly recommend her book to anybody who has a history of depression, eating disorder, or addiction, either personally or in your family history, because you're going to see yourself all over this book. And that was an amazing read for me. Gary Taub is another phenomenal writer. He's a science writer, and he wrote two famous articles that were in the New York Times that really kind of blew the lid off the lipid hypothesis for mainstream people. And he had a book that came out about a year and a half ago called Good Calories, Bad Calories. And if you haven't heard of this book, you've got to read it. It's fantastic. And he will walk you through the science of all of this just step by step by step, all the way back 100 years up to the present. So you can understand all the financial interests that changed public health recommendations toward a high-carb, low-fat diet, everything that went into that, why they're wrong, all the scientists who spoke against it, all the scientists who said, you're doing an experiment on the American public, we didn't sign up for this, it's only going to create damage. And, you know, it's 30, 40 years later, and indeed, you know, diabetes has quadrupled, heart disease is going up, it's, you know, all the things that they predicted have come true, because we are not meant for that diet. It's a phenomenal book. I mean, he spent 5 years researching it, and it's as comprehensive as you could ever want. So I highly recommend his book as well. The Eads, the doctors, Michael and Mary Dan Eads, their books are really accessible. Protein Powers was the first one, and they've got a whole slew of them, but they make the science really easy to understand. So if you've got weight control problems, if you're worried about your waistline, cholesterol problems, any kind of gut disorder, again, this is a great, great books to read, is the Doctor's Eads, because they make it really accessible, I think, to the general public.
E-A-D-E-S. And it's the same thing.
Yeah, EADES. And their work, I think, was pretty foundational to me, because, you know, when I was sort of trying to decide about, you know, my veganism, where had I gone wrong, why was I in such bad health, theirs was one of the first books that I found, and it really explained a lot to me about what I had done wrong. So I always recommend their books, because they're really easy to understand.
I've heard it said that the need for carbohydrates in human nutrition is zero.
It's true. There is no such thing as a necessary carbohydrate. Every molecule of sugar that your body needs, your body can create. And that's why, you know, you can find hunter-gatherers and fishing people that ate nothing but protein and fat. They did not eat any sweets at all. There's just no grain, no nothing. They didn't need it, and they achieved perfect health. The same cannot be true of our agriculturalists. The agriculturalists are always falling apart. We don't need it. We don't need any sugar at all.
And why is it that cod liver oil is considered the most important supplement for food?
Because it's got the really important fat-soluble vitamins, which would be A, D, and K. Those are in there in a very accessible form, and there's a lot of them. So if the only supplement you take, and if you can only do one, that would be it. You should take a tablespoon of that once or twice a day.
And there's a lot of cod liver oil in the market, so do a little research and find the stuff with the most integrity, and which has the genuinely superb reputation. I don't mind plugging Green Pastures. They
right.
come out of Nebraska, and there are articles on the manufacture of cod liver oil that can be found in the Weston Price quarterly magazines. And it's all there to be discovered for all the health seekers.
Yeah, and be a little cautious with cod liver oil, because what a lot of the companies are doing now is they take a perfectly wonderful product and then they put it through various industrial processes, and they take out the vitamin A and the vitamin D, and then they deodorize it, and then they add back in synthetic vitamin A and vitamin D. So you're not getting the same thing at all. You gotta aim for the manufacturers who are really using a traditional process, and they're out there. But don't just go to the co-op and buy whatever's there, because it might not actually be what you're looking for. And the synthetic versions of vitamin A and vitamin D are really different than the natural occurring forms. So you want to avoid that if you can. Try to find the really good stuff. Another company is Radiant Life, and they have an online website, and they have all kinds of great products. But
they're local here. They're in Healdsburg.
They're in California.
Yeah.
And they do a great job. So they've got all kinds of great books, lots of other good products, nutritional products.
Right. You can call them up, get a catalog, or email them. They'll send you a new catalog. Let's go into politics, Leah.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, one of the other myths about the vegetarian diet is that this will cure world hunger, and you know that we're handed these very simple ideas that it takes 18 pounds of grain to make a pound of beef, and if we all stop eating meat, that grain would instead go to starving children. And it's that idea is wrong at every step of the argument. And it's because people are just naive. It's not, I mean, people really do want to help. They really want to do something for world hunger. But that equation is not actually how the world works. So, I mean, there are plenty of good reasons not to eat factory-farmed beef, but feeding hungry children will never be one of them. So to break this down a little bit further, you've got six grain cartels, and these are just vast corporations, and they control essentially the entire world of agriculture. Six of them means it's a monopoly. That means that they can command a price for any kind of grain that is below the cost of production. So farmers are out there trying as hard as they can. No matter how much of the stuff they grow, they can't even break even. What happens then is the United States government, the federal government, steps in and will provide, you know, sort of a stopgap. So all these farm bills, that's what they're doing, is, well, how much are we going to pay farmers to keep them in business? So this is all because the grain cartels have been able to, you know, command this really low price. So farmers are in this terrible position where they're always having to produce more just to keep their heads above water. And what that means is that, of course, there's this huge glut of things like corn and wheat on the market because there's way more every year. And a lot of this was made possible by the Green Revolution. So, you know, applying nitrogen fertilizer means that you're going to have these huge surpluses. And then, of course, with having these six corporations take over the entire world food supply, it's, the situation's only gotten worse. So mountains of corn have been produced since 1950. Because the farmers had to keep producing more, it suddenly became, and the grain got so cheap, it suddenly became possible to invent something like, you know, factory farming, confinement animal operations. That didn't exist before 1950, and the reason that it was created was because of industrial agriculture. So you've got the animals off the land, they're living in these horrible, hellish conditions. On the land, you've got, you know, topsoil being degraded and degraded over and over because there's no animal products being added at all, just nitrogen fertilizer. And then you've got these huge surpluses. And the surpluses are now fed to the animals because it will make them grow really fast. It will also kill them because it's not their native diet. And it will produce products that are not really fit for human consumption either. But that's what's been happening since 1950. So, you know, you can withdraw from eating factory farmed meat, which I would encourage anybody to do, but that's not the problem. They're not growing that corn in order to feed it to animals. They're growing that corn because these six corporations are commanding such a low price that farmers are stuck having to grow more and more and more of it. It ended up being fed to animals because it was so cheap, but they've got the equation backwards. When the vegetarians make this argument, they're not understanding the political reality of what's going on by having, you know, these six corporations control the world's food supply. So it's one thing. The other thing is, this is a model that in any other circumstances, you know, progressives would never accept. There's no reason that somebody in Sri Lanka or Cambodia should be dependent on the United States for basic foodstuffs. I mean, we used to call that imperialism, where, you know, the power, you know, the people with the power go out and they conquer and they get colonies, and then they make those colonies dependent on the, you know, the imperial country for basic things like food. And that means that the people in the colony have to sell whatever they've got in order to buy basic supplies. So it forces them into a money economy that will only benefit the imperial power, and it destroys their local economies, and now they have to sell their timber, their fish, their topsoil, their minerals, whatever they've got, oil, they have to sell that back to the imperial country, and maybe one of the things they have to sell is labor. So it means they're going to be making, you know, sneakers for 10 cents an hour in factories in China. This is not an arrangement that anybody could call justice. There's no reason that those people should need food from the United States. It's only because, you know, the imperial powers have destroyed their local economies. And some of the main people responsible for this are, in fact, those six corporations that control the world food supply. And so they've gone into country after country and destroyed the local food economy very, very purposefully, because they want people to be dependent on their crappy products. So, you know, for instance, you've got farmers in the Philippines, 50% of them are now at risk because of the price of corn in the United States. They cannot produce corn or any kind of grain as cheaply as these giant cartels can, and that's because the United States taxpayer is making up the difference. I mean, we give these giant farm subsidies so that corporations can buy it that cheaply, and then the subsidies come in to keep the farmers here afloat just barely, but it means that these things are incredibly cheap, and they call it agricultural dumping. And we understand it when Walmart does it. They come into town, they sell things really cheap, they destroy the local economy, and then everybody's stuck having to buy crap at Walmart. Well, it's the same thing with agriculture. They go into a new country, they flood the market with cheap corn or cheap wheat or cheap whatever. It destroys the local economy. People lose their land. They're forced to go move to cities, which are just swollen with poverty and squalor and starvation, and the local, all those local economies are destroyed. And that's what's been going on for the last, 50 to 100 years. It's bizarre to me that people who consider themselves progressive or liberal or radical hold this up as some kind of model. I mean, it's exactly the opposite of the kind of world that we want. And yet when it comes to food, somehow the grain cartels are supposed to be providing food for, hungry people elsewhere. In fact, it's exactly that's creating the mass starvation. It's the destruction of our local economies. So I would say on every level, as much as the vegetarians claim to care, and they're certainly not lying, they do want a just world, but they don't understand the facts of this. Because, this idea that if we just stop eating factory farmed meat, everything will be fine, politically, it's just wrong.
It's naive.
It's very naive. I mean, that's part of the problem. But we like simple answers. I mean, I loved that when I was 16. It was beautiful that, with one act, I could cure so much that was wrong with the world. And, if life was that simple, it would all be a lot better. But
right. we,
it's not that simple. And right. We're up against a lot more power. And it's going to take a lot more struggle to bring real justice to this planet.
Right. It wouldn't hurt to outgrow our childhood.
Yeah. Yeah. Ultimately, we're going to have to grow up and take up our adult responsibilities. But it's never easy.
The suffering is ghastly, and people all over the world are our family. These are our kin, and that we could stand by and get bought off by what Derek calls the comforts and elegancies of Western life is obscene, and it's shameful ultimately. And this is all part of growing up and taking a look in the mirror and taking it all on, taking it in and taking it on. And that's the only way we're going to begin to transform this, and we're going to have to transform this in one big hurry.
Right.
I'd like to move now into the area of morality, which is the first, after your introductory chapter. This is your first chapter in the book, and it's a whopper. And I think this is where the rubber meets the road. This is where the real difficulty comes in for so many of us, because the dirty reality, which is not dirty at all, but the dark secret in the center of all of this is killing.
Right.
And what killing is, and how we are interrelated with all other species, and how the earth works, and the nature of life and death, and the soil and the earth and all of it. Please let us let's hear from it. Let's hear it.
Yeah, I think the hardest moment for me was right at the beginning of this whole process, because I decided that I wanted to grow as much of my food as I could. This was one of the things that's been promoted as, a way to reduce your carbon footprint. And, I love getting my hands in the dirt, and I was really excited about learning to garden. So I started my first little garden, and the amount of death that was involved in starting that garden, it destroyed me. I mean, it was horrifying, because I wanted this to be this peaceful, loving, wonderful, nonviolent,
death-free, this death-free world.
Yeah, the lion down playing with the lamb, lion lies down with the lamb, and we're all going to love each other, and nobody ever has to die or suffer. And it was really hard to watch, because it wasn't true. And just even having a 10-by-10 garden meant that hundreds, if not thousands, of animals died. And those animals are called insects. They don't generally count on people's moral radar. I'm not sure why. I mean, we still share most of our genes with them.
They're so other.
I guess they're not quite us. But, a lot of them do take care of their young just like we do. That was the moment that really got me, was watching the ants. I moved a rock, out of the way, just so I could have a slightly bigger garden. And I must have killed, 500 ant babies that day, because there they were under the rock. And watching the nursery ants run for all they were worth, holding up as many ant babies as they could carry, it was horrifying. Because it was like, well, that's what I would do in a disaster. You know, you grab the baby and you run. And it was really hard. It was like, they love themselves. They love their community. They love their babies just like we do. And I'm killing them so that I can have a garden. And that was really hard because I had believed that my life was possible. So then, you know, finally you get the garden established. Well, you know, lots and lots of creatures want to eat that garden. It's not just me. So we're head to head. What are we going to do? And I had this just tremendous moral, just this, you know, dead end where it was like, what am I going to do about the slugs? The slugs were destroying the garden. So it's me or the slugs. Who's going to eat? And I went through all kinds of things trying to get the slugs out of the garden without killing them. And in the end, I had to admit that I was going to kill them, that I could pretend I wasn't, but they were going to die for me to have that food. And I tried to sort of abandon the garden for a few days and, well, I just won't eat from the garden. I'll let the slugs have it. But then I went to the store. I was like, okay, I'll buy my lettuce and my peppers and my watermelon here. And, you know, I had to admit, well, whoever grew these also killed slugs. Wherever they're growing this food, they killed insects to get it. And they also had to kill some mammals and probably some birds because those critters want to get into my garden too. So I can do all the fencing I want. But, you know, the moment I demarcate that land, it means that, you know, there's one less rabbit that can live here or one less fox or one less deer because I'm taking over that territory. It was really hard. So, you know, going to the store was not an option at that point. I knew too much. I had already learned what I didn't want to learn, which was that in every head of lettuce was embodied quite a bit of animal death. And I didn't want that to be true. So, and then, of course, there's the fertilizer problem. What am I going to fertilize this garden with? I didn't want to use manure because, you know, animals were oppressed by farming. I believe that very strongly. And I didn't want anything to do with, you know, butter, blood or bone meal, of course. I mean, that was even worse. But in the end, I could see I was degrading the soil without feeding it. And even if I didn't want to eat animals, well, it didn't really matter. The plants wanted to eat animals, and the soil wanted to eat animals. And I had to come to grips with that. So I sort of made a kind of a deal there that, well, I'll go to a barn and I'll get some manure, but I'm not the one who's keeping those animals. So I managed to get some manure, and of course the garden just exploded. I mean, it was the land that time forgot. And eventually I ended up getting my own chickens. I mean, that was where it began. Was like, well, they'll eat the bugs. I won't have to. They'll give me the manure. It'll be right here. They will repair this land for me, and they'll be really cute on top of it. But, you know, I had to admit that these bugs are going to have to die in order for me to eat that food.
Right.
And that was really hard. So right. It was, again, one of those moments of looking in the mirror and trying to learn to be an adult of a very large community, the community of, you know, life on Earth. I can do this well, or I can pretend it's not happening and then do it poorly. So I decided to do it well instead, or as good as I could. But that meant, you know, engaging with chickens, getting more creatures onto this land and letting them do their job, which they have fun doing. I mean, chickens love eating bugs. It makes them really happy. And watching them do it.
And it makes the yolks nice and orange and stand up in the frying pan, and they're delicious.
Absolutely.
And loaded with nutrition.
Nothing you get at the store. You've never had an egg if you've never had an actual egg from a chicken that's out on pasture.
From a bug-eating chicken.
Yes.
And even more so when the farm has ruminants on it and the manure and the chickens, more bugs, more it's wonderful.
Yeah, more life.
More life.
And so if you have never had anything but an egg from your grocery store, go and find some real eggs. And then the next step really is get yourself some chickens. Even in a really small backyard, you can get chickens.
Yeah.
And they will be the joy of your days. And they will teach you so much about this whole process.
And talk to the farmers at the farmers markets.
Yes. Yeah, and find out. And the sad part is that, you know, not every farmer at a farmers market is doing the right thing.
Right.
So you do have to ask questions because sometimes the chickens are still...
You'll find the real farmers.
Yeah, right. You got to find the right ones. They really have to be doing pasturing. Their animals have to be out, not just in a run that they've completely scratched to bare dirt, and they're not really getting any fresh greens and no bugs. And I mean, they don't just eat bugs. I mean, I got to tell you, I've watched. They eat small animals like mice and chipmunks, mammals. They'll try to take down a squirrel, which is really funny to watch. But they also eat reptiles and amphibians. So you'll see them eating snakes, frogs, whatever they can get their beaks into, they will eat. They also eat each other. I mean, there's no honor among fowl.
Right. And we're going to get eaten too.
Yeah. Well, that was the end point for me. Was, well, you know, when it's my turn, it's like, I'm going to have to go gracefully because a lot of creatures have given their lives for me. And when it's my turn, I hope that I can be recycled right back into it. So
this death thing is not just hard. It's very hard.
Yeah, I agree.
Very, very hard. And this is where maybe human maturity begins, or where this is something that we're going to have to come to grips with emotionally and realistically, and understand that it's not a tragedy. We don't really necessarily understand the nature of life and death, or we misperceive it, or we're so afraid, or we're so whatever we are, all our childish fears, and we're not raised in a culture where death is part of life and where there's a natural order to things.
Right.
I don't know if you ever heard of a movie called The Tree of Wooden Clogs. It's an old Italian film about, it takes us through a whole annual cycle, all these peasant farmers living on the land. And it's a beautiful, beautiful film. And there's a scene where it's the time of the year where it's time to gut the pig or gut the hog, this giant, giant hog.
Right.
And they show you, they string the hog up and they slit it wide open. And, there's a lot of squeals and a lot of blood and a lot of guts. And the kids there, it's part of the deal. It's part of who we are and part of terrestrial life and part of embodiment. And, you could say it much better than I, but I'm coming back to it because, this I think is at the very heart of the resistance to the lawful, humane exchange that humans have with animals in terms of food and nutrition. And this is a focus that's going to take quite a bit of careful carefully presented understanding. This is something that we need to come to terms with.
Right.
Maybe more than anything because we're all so terrified of.
Yeah. And I mean, all the cultures, I think that, you know, if you go back far enough in anybody's ancestry, you know, you have people who live on the land and, you know, understood these things, but it's all been broken for most of us anyway. We need to get that knowledge back in whatever way we can. And if you know, if you come from a culture that still has that, then boy, you should be really thankful and make sure that you learn from your grandparents and, you know, your parents, whatever it is they have to teach you about it, because a lot of us are just out here floundering around. You know, it got broken a few centuries ago and we don't know how to get it back. I mean, at this point, you know, so many of us live surrounded by cement and the sound of machines, and what do we know about topsoil or grass or cows or mice or any of it? It's all this completely foreign world, and, you know, we spent 4 million years as a part of it, and it's only been in the last, you know, just a little bit of human time that we've gotten separated from it. So it's a homecoming, too. I mean, it's not just a sad thing and a hard thing, but it really should be a celebratory moment as well for, you know, for this culture to embrace something that's more life-affirming and, you know, more of what we're designed to experience is, you know, that participation in the life of the planet and ultimately the life of the cosmos.
We ourselves are the fruit of the earth. We're fruit of the earth. We wouldn't exist. There is no human without the earth. And we've been pretending that we don't live here anymore, or that we're going somewhere else or something equally nuts.
Right. So we have to accept our embodiment, you know, which I think is hard. I mean, this is not a culture that at all appreciates the human body as it really is.
Right. Do you mind staying on for a few more minutes?
That's fine.
What do you know about A2 milk? I've been reading about, I forget the name of the book from this guy from New Zealand about how we can convert our herds, our dairy herds, to A2 milk, which is the good stuff.
Right. You might know more than me. I've only heard little bits about it, and it sounds really intriguing. But if you've read the book, then you're already one up on me. So
well, it was pretty. I couldn't read it. It was a difficult read. It was rather dry. But what I got from it is that somehow we got away from milk is either dairy cows are either A1 or A2. They're milk, and there are different pathogens. Oh, I can't talk about it, but I can put it on the table. There's something very real, and it has to do with the quality of milk, the Guernseys and the Jerseys.
Right.
Are the finest.
Heirloom breeds. That's what you want.
Heirloom breeds.
Yeah.
And it's important that there's a lot of evidence that generally the milk that we get, first of all, we want, there's a whole movement toward, restoring the ease of access and the approval of using raw milk products, which are demonstrably much healthier than the milk that's pasteurized and that we find in the supermarkets. And then reading about this A2A2 or this A1A2 business with the dairy herds, there's evidence, that generally much of the milk that we consume is injurious to us. How's that,
yeah,
folks?
Yeah, very
you know,
good.
It's like everything we know is wrong, is not too far off. But
and they used to pay farmers for milk based on the fat content. So basically, you know, the more dense, the more nutrient dense the milk was, the more money they'd get for it. That's the way it should be.
Of course.
All of that flipped, you know, as corporate America takes control of the food supply. Now farmers are just paid essentially by dumb weight. So it doesn't really matter what the nutrient quality is. So what happens is, all of a sudden, farmers need to breed cows that, instead of producing nutrient-dense milk, will just produce a huge volume of milk. So this is where you get, you know, all these cows that are essentially, you know, descended from very few cows. I mean, and they're all basically all Holsteins. And so it's the A2 thing, A1, that these are the wrong kind of cows, that they were all descended from, you know, the cows that didn't have the right genes. But it was done so because of, again, the corporate influence that farmers were no longer being paid to produce a product that was of quality, that it was all about quantity. So they had to switch. And so now all these cows can produce just 10,000 gallons a year instead of 800 gallons a year.
Right.
That's a vast quantity of milk. And, of course, when it's essentially just water being pumped through them. I mean, there's no way that, you know, producing that much milk, and it's going to have much, you know, very many nutrients in it. So, that's why it had happened historically.
Right. And they suffer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's horrible to be one of those cows. It's terrible.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah. Yeah. The mastitis. And, of course, we're drinking all that infection, too.
Right.
First time I ever had real milk. I mean, I finished, you know, I was sort of done with my vegan days and decided, all right, I'm going to try this new way of food. And I got all the Weston Price information. And I was living in Massachusetts then. And I went to a farm that was, at this point, it was underground. You had to be into the, you know, the milk underground to get raw milk. But it was a beautiful little farm. And he has 200 acres that was, has been in his family line for seven generations. He's been a dairy farmer. The land is in gorgeous shape, and he only has Jersey cows. And he will sell you underground the raw milk. Now, it's gotten a lot more legalized in Massachusetts. It's been great strides made with that. But at that point, you know, you had to sort of be underground about it. And, you know, you bring your own container, and he filled me up with a few gallons of milk, and I went home, and they're all grass-fed. It's all raw. They're Jersey cows. Everything was perfect. And I let the cream separate, and I was just like, you know, a third of it is cream. I mean, it's absolutely gorgeous. And I had never done this before. I mean, I didn't know anything about it. I was like, all right, I'm going to try this. So I let it sit for 24 hours to, you know, let it do its thing a little bit and to culture, naturally culture. And then I put it in the blender, and I made butter. And I sat and ate it with a spoon. I mean, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven.
Right.
It tasted nothing like anything I had ever eaten before. It was so good.
Right.
So if you've never had, it's like with the eggs, if you've never had real food, you do not know what you are missing. And I will tell you that your taste buds and your tongue and your brain will respond if you get some real food in you. Because this is the food we were meant for.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's regeneration.
Yes.
Physical regeneration.
Yeah.
Isn't that
yeah.
something? I've had a crisis recently with butter because I've given up eating bread and I don't know what to put my butter on.
I know, right?
You know?
Yeah.
Well,
a
I need something.
For butter.
Yeah,
yeah,
I need a vehicle for butter. And, you can
believe it or not, apples. I use little tiny apple slices. You can put butter on. It's really good.
Yeah.
A little cinnamon on top. It's
yeah.
really yummy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is marvelous. It's all good news. It's very good news. You know, it's good news if you've been feeling like, you know what for too many years, and you've been to too many doctors who don't help you at all.
Right.
And somehow you drag yourself off to one more doctor, and he or she gives you an accurate diagnosis, and gives you a protocol for actually regenerating your health.
Yes.
This is great good news, and this is that's what the vegetarian myth is. When all the hard areas are presented, and all the conflicts with what we've been believing for so many years are processed, at the end of the run, what we're left with is an exhilarating, liberatory, gift from you.
Well,
Ms.
thank you.
Keith. Any final thoughts? By the way, Joel Saladin's going to come on the show in a few weeks.
Oh, exciting.
And, you folks out there, you get in touch with Polyface Farms. He's a farmer in Virginia, and I know that he has at least one long DVD, which is wonderful, wonderful, wonderful to see. Have you seen the DVD from Polyface?
No, you're in for a treat.
It's terrific. You see how this man and his family and his extended family, his staff, or the other farmers, you see how they handle every facet of farming and how it all blends together. It's wonderful, because if it's happening once anywhere, right. It can be duplicated. It's
right.
It's a map. It's a map for our regeneration. How good is that?
And he's really good too, because it's so hands on. I mean, he's been doing it since 1962 or something. So
yeah.
You can pick up his book and learn how to do it yourself if you want.
Right.
You can learn to actually get a piece of land and how to make it happen. So he's great, because he's got the theory and he's got the practice. So it's all there in one package.
Yeah. And it's there for us to discover.
Right.
And it's terrific. Anything else you want to throw in before we throw in the towel?
This is a tough moment on planet Earth, and whatever your passion is out there, we've got to put it to use now. This is our last opportunity to save our planet, and we need to live with that every day and let ourselves be motivated to do what needs to be done.
Amen. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Be well, and we'll catch you down the road.
All right. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
Bye.
Lier Keith, the author of The Vegetarian Myth, published by, I guess it's co-published by Flashpoint Press out of Crescent City, California, and PM Press out of Oakland, California. And it's quite a read, and quite an urgent, important, necessary, vital, critical communication. It's more than a book. It's a communication that's grounded in the earth, grounded in reality, grounded in well-being and intelligence, and there's no excuses. We can do this, and the first step is always to go to school. So go get a copy of The Vegetarian Myth by Lier Keith, LIERREKEITH, subtitled Food, Justice, and Sustainability.